yes, that you know, that one can't get justice in this country. I didn't quite follow why.
And you think the only reason they haven't had justice is that they've been breaking up the trials themselves?
Yes, it was not a very balanced statement.
Oh, it was a very well. I don't admire Brewster.
Well, perhaps only the attack by Agnew makes him look better in comparison. I don't know.
Well, I think that'll carry a lot of people with Agnew. What Agnew said was very true, I think.
Uh-huh.
Well, but Agnew's not popular in the academic world.
No, and yet, as you say, that's not the biggest world either. There's
no, it isn't. And the sad thing is, the academic world doesn't realize today how they have been alienated from the general mass of the people.
You feel that the fault lies with the academic world itself?
Well, I think to a very great degree, the way they supported the FSM movement. That is not, when you say the academic world, you mean a little group of noisy activists in it. They supported the FSM movement, and they've encouraged the students. There was no solid front against all the rioting. We know how many professors were behind it, and that goes out all over the country. And I really think our status with the people of California is awfully low. And I don't think any of the academics realize it. I do, being outside now. The people of California were so proud of the university that money came so easily. Legislature was generous year after year. I don't remember when I was on the board ever having our budgets really seriously cut in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And now, you couldn't get a bond issue through for the university today. And I don't think we hope we'll get this bond issue through for the medical schools.
Yes, is that Proposition 1?
Yes, but that's for the medical schools. And that's got an appeal. But if you put it up to the university, oh dear. For the university in general, it would be terrifying. I hope I wasn't on the air.
You were on the air, but this is, you know, have the blue pencil when you see this transcribed.
Yeah.
Actually, I hope some of your opinions, or all of them really, will be left in, because I think it's very important to capture what is being thought at the moment. And these views are lost if someone isn't saying it, you know. So I think this certainly is relevant. After all, you have every right to speak about the university and about university.
Well, we all love the university so much. It's just terribly disturbing to see the university get into such a situation of intense antagonism now between the academic world and the outside world.
Well, do you really think that if the, very, very many of the faculty, of course, did not go along with the rioting.
Surely.
But even if none of the faculty had gone along with the rioting, would it have made any difference, do you think?
I think that if the faculty leadership had taken a strong, indignant stand against the rioting, saying this is intolerable, that we cannot have things of this sort on the university, and backed up the administration strongly, it would have made all the difference in the world. Right at the beginning in the FSM movement, that's when things got out of control, terribly. And it's just escalated from there to other universities and so on.
However, I think I don't know whether one could say that the faculty exerted leadership for the rioting particularly, I have the feeling. Or do you, that the leadership comes elsewhere?
Well, in that famous meeting, in the midst of the SFM riots, when the faculty met and they were their discussions were being broadcast to a mob outside, and the mob was roaring, and the faculty practically endorsed the demands of the mob, which I think was a shocking thing, and it shocked California. Now, again, you know but a small fraction of the faculty attend university meetings.
Yes, they can scarcely get a quorum most of the time.
I think there was, that time, an unusually big crowd, but at the same time, the people who speak, the emotional people, are 9/10 on the extreme left side. I've gone to a few meetings since I've been a professor emeritus,
oh, yes.
And I have not been impressed with the quality of the debate or the balance that you find in a group of highly intellectual people.
How do you account for the silence on the part of others?
I don't know. I think, for the most part, that they are gentle, scholarly people, and they don't like that type of rough debate. But the debates I've heard have been more like these acrimonious debates you have when you're in labor negotiations in a faculty meeting. Except in labor negotiations, everybody knows they're pitted against each other's side and they're friendly enough afterwards.
I see. This way you're not friendly at any time,
no.
I gather.
Well, we'll see what happens today. It's going to be a pretty dreadful day. I hope things don't break loose too much in Yale. But how an intellectual institution could stand up and defend these murderers among the Panthers, and some of them are confessed murderers, and say they can't get justice is beyond me. They're the ones who are preventing justice by creating all this heckling in the courts. If you'd have a fair, orderly trial before a jury, they'd get justice. I'm sure they could have justice. But the people who are obstructing justice are these wild people. Mm-hmm. Time after time it's worked that way. And now to have a man high in the academic world come out and say that the Panthers can't get justice is just incredible to me.
Well, there does seem to have been an interesting shift in who needs protection in the courts. It used to be that the accused did.
Yes.
Reading occasionally some articles to the effect that it is now really the judge and the process who need the
yes.
protection.
Well, I think this is a deliberately planned technique on the part of a group of very skilled, more or less professional revolutionists, and they're doing a wonderful job. And the students are one of the easiest groups you can lead around. I think this same group of the extreme left revolutionary group tried to take over the labor union some 10 or 20 years ago and really did not get very far. Mm-hmm. The laboring man basically is pretty conservative when it comes to that sort of thing. And now I think there's the same attempt being made to take over the universities by organizing this student violence. It's an old technique. It's the Latin American technique. I've seen it for 50 years in Latin America.
Oh, no.
Revolutions start among the students.
In Peru also?
Oh, yes. And little groups get them organized. And you can get a mob of students raging on the streets very easily. And then the group that want to manipulate them, manipulate them. And well, not very long ago, you know, the University of Mexico was shut down for a long time.
Yes.
By being taken over by mobs. And we've had a feeling that that could never happen in America. And yet it's happened. And now it's grown unbelievably. I didn't think our students were so stupid, but they are. They're easily taken in. And I didn't think that group of wild people on the faculty could be so stupid and so dangerous. And there again, there's a little hardcore of them, I'm sure, that are really devoted revolutionists. It'd be a dreadful thing if they succeed.
Yes, it certainly would.
Because and if it goes too far, and I think we're well on our way now, it is so likely to split up into a really harsh conflict between this group of revolutionists and the equally obnoxious extremist groups on the other side of the fascist, Nazi, extreme communist type. That's the pattern.
They do need each other, don't they?
Oh, yes. Well, then one or the other takes over. They're both interested in power. I don't think ideas play much pay very much, count very much. It's power thereafter. And before one or the other gets power, there could be a terrible fight. I hope that's not going to happen. But the moderates are going to have to wake up. They'll have to do more than just stand, have rocks thrown at them.
I suppose, as you suggest, it does come down to a question of leadership.
Yes, it really does. And so far, I don't think our big moderate group has had the leadership that's needed. Mm-hmm. We've had leadership of wonderful people. I couldn't admire anybody more than I do a person like Roger Hines. Mm-hmm. But somehow I do think it's going to take very dramatic leadership of a quality that generally we don't breed in the academic world or like very much.
Perhaps it will have to be a political leader, you think?
Well, I don't
or
know.
Where do you suspect it might?
I don't know. If it's hard to say where you'd find them. You'd think they could come from the faculty ranks. You'd think there'd be somebody or somebody emerging from the faculty ranks would have that quality. I must say I haven't seen that quality of leadership among the few conservatives in the faculty group either.
No.
You know them as well as I do. Mm-hmm. They're not men that really command any following or are able to dramatize things at all.
Do you suppose it would have to be someone who is going to deal with, let's say, the inequities in society also, since this seems to be part of the fuel for the, at least for the debate?
I think that would be part of the ploy, but I think the inequities of the society really don't concern most of these people. They're after power, and they'll jump from one thing to another.
Oh, right.
They started with free speech, which was a completely phony issue, if there ever was one. There's been no institution freer than this, really. Just arguing about whether you use one particular place, but there was no question they could do all the free talking on the campus they wanted. Then they hopped to civil rights, and then Vietnam gave them just what they wanted. And then they tie into the ROTC, which is just as phony an issue, almost, as free speech. And the majority of students want ROTC. They voted it even at Stanford. Mm-hmm. They haven't had a vote here, but the faculty are supporting ROTC. Mm-hmm. But here is a place where you can rally opposition.
This curious aspect of not really any longer believing in free speech.
No, and in the very first movement, Ed Strong was heckled and shouted down.
Oh, yes.
The first university meeting when that thing was starting, when they were starting for free speech, and they interrupted him.
Yes.
And wouldn't allow him to make a speech. Just think how shocking that was. And could anybody be a more liberal, fair-minded person than Ed Strong?
No, exactly.
Stating a case, both sides, and really giving good intellectual leadership, but nothing that arouses the opposition that was needed.
Right. But just thinking back over the various, well, the many people you have known, both in industrial and intellectual, I guess, academic is a better word, fields, who, can you think of someone who seemed to you to be a leader who had the requisite qualities?
Well, if we go back, Bob Sproul had it.
I see.
As a leader. And I think that in an emergency, with his presence and his voice and his manner, he could have probably played a very dramatic and a very effective part if he'd been the Bob Sproul of 25 years ago. I think of the people I've known in the academic world, in high positions, he had that quality of leadership. And I really don't... Well, the other presidents I know, Lowell had great qualities of leadership, but not that sort. He was just an extremely arrogant intellectual, but he ran things with an iron hand.
Now, from where was he?
That was Harvard.
That was Harvard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Conant, whom I knew much better than Lowell, was, I think, an even greater intellectual than Lowell, but and a very firm person, but not one to tell people off the way Lowell could.
I see.
And or could take command of a situation in the dramatic way that Bob Sproul could.
Of course, he too had his troubles with the
well. Bob made a terrible mistake in following some advice that the it would be a good thing vis-a-vis Sacramento to have an oath that would show the legislature that the university professors were normal and all behind the country. And that was a terrible mistake that Spall went along with that advice. That almost wrecked him.
Yes, was that Mr. Nyland who...
No, it wasn't Nyland.
It was not?
No, well, I really think it was probably Jim Corley's advice.
Oh, I see. Yes, of course, the Sacramento connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure done with the greatest good faith in the sense that they thought this would be a fine thing for the university vis-a-vis the legislators without, on his part at least, any understanding of what it would mean to some members of the faculty. And I'm very surprised that Bob Sproul didn't realize that. I don't think he paid much attention to it in the early stages.
No, an odd lack of sensitivity in it.
Yes, but I'm surprised that he must have been preoccupied with other things because he knew the faculty awfully well. But it just caught him off base. And then it developed into this intense antagonism on the board. Between Sproul and Nyland. And what there is all in that background, I don't know, because in Nyland's longer history, he had often been on the rather liberal side.
Exactly, yes. Now, was he the attorney for the Hearst?
He was the attorney for W.R. Hearst for years. Mm-hmm. And he was... And he had been in Sacramento, you know. He held a high appointed post in Sacramento for quite a while.
You're right. I've
and
forgotten
so he was very he was experienced in politics in Sacramento. And by and large, from his general career and his interests, he'd been very much on the liberal side of things, but. Something occurred, and of course this is all written up, that made him feel he'd been double-crossed in some way, and he became intensely antagonistic to Sproul. And it was a bitter time on the Regents. I came in right in the midst of it.
Yes, I was thinking you were right there during a large part of this. Did you come in with any preconceived views about the wisdom of
Well, I was on the alumni committee. That was appointed by the president of the Alumni Association with Steve Bechtel as chairman, and they attempted to propose a compromise. That little plaque up there, that middle one, was the one the Alumni Association gave me for being on that committee.
Oh, yes.
And we went to see all sorts of people. We went to see, talked to Nyland at great length. I'd known Nyland a long time. And we talked to Giannini. And we talked to all the regents. And I know Steve Bechtel was most anxious to try to find some solution that would get the university out of this, to all of us, a perfectly meaningless row. If I'd been on the faculty, I would have taken the oath without any hesitation. And I'm loyal to my country. Forget all about it, and the whole thing would have been forgotten. Nobody would ever have been prosecuted. It was a silly technique, anyway. But it just was the sort of thing that was terribly disturbing to a number of very idealistic people. And to punish them for their unwillingness to take an oath was perfectly outrageous. So I was on this, being an absolute conservative, I was on the side of the liberals in that.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. And Ireland, really in its history in some ways far more liberal than I am, was fighting the professors. It was a strange, mixed-up thing. And I don't think it did the university near the harm that the people who were emotional felt that it did one way or the other. And in the end, it all worked out. Nobody lost their jobs. A couple resigned and left, but there are always people resigning and leaving, and new people coming. But it was a rather dramatic time. Then the alumni committee came up with a statement that they thought everybody could get along with. And that tried to set up a procedure whereby a professor who wouldn't take the oath would be excused from taking the oath if it was established that he had no sinister connections of one sort or another. And the regents adopted it, but then, as I remember, proceeded to go ahead with when they happened to have the one vote necessary to do it. It was just like this, you know, on the board, say, well, we've given them a fair trial, hang them attitude, you know. And it didn't work.
So that proposal never was implemented?
It was it did not work out the way the group of the alumni committee thought it was going to work.
Was Dan Koshland on this committee with you?
I haven't seen
a roster of the names. I should look it up just as a matter of interest.
Yes, I don't think Dan was on that. John Simpson was. You look up the whole list.
Yes, there has been a recent book on the oath, Gardner's book.
Yes,
on the oath.
I must, you know, he should have sent me a copy of that,
yes,
but he didn't.
Should.
Because he came to see me about it. He sent it to practically everybody else on the board, but I think I was just overlooked. Anyway, I'm going to get one and read it.
Yes.
I hear it's a quite a well-balanced story.
I had that impression from the parts that I had read, that he did attempt to find the facts.
Yes. The thing that I really think the way it was settled was, and Jesse Steinhardt played a big part in this, was to work it out so that all the faculty took the oath imposed by the Levering Act. Was it the Levering Act? It was based on a constitutional amendment anyway, that all employees of the state of California had to take this oath. And while we could have quibbled, the university faculties are under the regents, not under the state government, therefore they would be exempt from the oath. That, we felt that we wouldn't get into that. So it was proposed to rescind the regents' oath. I think I made the motion to rescind the regents' oath. And I remember when I asked Marjorie Wallman to write that out, she sort of gasped.
She did.
And then to require that all members of the faculty take the oath imposed by the Constitution of California.
Now that was...
Now I'm oversimplifying a complex procedure, but that is essentially what happened, and nobody objected to that. But Harvard, everybody on the Harvard faculty took an oath like that, imposed by the legislature of Massachusetts. They didn't like it, but they took it.
Yes, I do remember the argument that faculty members hated being singled out.
Yes.
How did this solution suggest itself to you?
Oh, I think it was it was Jesse Steinhardt's good legal mind saw this way through. Now, Jesse was a thoroughgoing liberal, but awfully anxious to work out something that would resolve this situation. And so that more or less terminated the oath row, with the exception of the lawsuit that was brought by the group of professors, some of whom had been discharged, which they won. And they were reinstated with back pay.
And this was the one that Tolman was
Tolman was involved in that, yes.
Edward Tolman.
Yes. So with that lawsuit, and the winning of that lawsuit by the professors, the situation came to an end. Now I don't know that... Do they take an oath at all now?
There, until recently, there has been an oath that every employee takes.
Of all, that's the state of California.
Yes, and
the
people on the staff
all
take it. But as I understand it, very, very recently, this has been withdrawn.
And I think that was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, which overrode the state of California's constitution.
I see. So we're really...
And what difference? The whole thing is so silly because a communist or an extreme revolutionist doesn't mind taking a dozen doses.
Oh, of course not.
And how? What can you do? You can't try them successfully for perjury or pose any penalties on them. And then look at this girl from... Southern California, what's her name?
Angela Davis.
Angela Davis. I suppose she's taken the oath. Oh, no, I guess now she doesn't have to.
Now she doesn't have to.
But she violated, after she was appointed, then she announced she was a card-carrying member of the party, mm-hmm. violating the existing rules. Of course, that's in the courts now.
Yes, and that rule is to the effect that...
No, that it is contrary to the policy of the university to employ a member of, I don't know how it's worded, but of a party that demands complete allegiance to their principles and so on. Mm-hmm. That is, on the theory that a person of that sort would not be a free agent and could not really enjoy what we call academic freedom.
Yes, that's an interesting theory. Of course, I suppose if one were really very devious, he would just never join.
Well, that's this is the first time, really, I think anyone has come out deliberately and said they were. I'm sure there have been communists on the faculty who would never admit it. I think almost any association you can get into in life, you'll find people like that. It's not just the faculty, but the if she came out, to have someone come out and admit it was a deliberate play. And I think with the emotionalism about the blacks now and the general sweep of disturbance and liberalism that's going on, extreme liberalism I would call it, why, I think they made a deliberate play. Let's run this into the courts, make a case out of it. Mm-hmm. And Lord knows she's had plenty of support. Mm-hmm. Had a favorable decision from the first judge, but of course that case is going very much higher.
Well, as you touch on various controversies, it sometimes seems that there's so much heat over what is really perhaps not a central issue.
Yes, but now then what would seem to us to be a non-essential issue, some of these good professionals can take it and blow it up into something that becomes a very great emotional issue, mm-hmm. capable of creating an enormous disturbance, mm-hmm. such as the free speech movement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that had so many other elements involved, it's hard to separate them out. Well, we seem to be in your...
Well, we ought to get back to where we were. I've forgotten where we were.
Well, this is a very good spot, because we were going to get you back to... the University of California after your years on the faculty at Harvard.
Oh, yes.
And of course, you then, not long after you came back to Cal, you were named regent. Is
Yes, it was shortly after I served on this alumni committee that Giannini died. Giannini, Mario Giannini, had just been reappointed to a 16-year term, and he died, I think, a few months after that. And I was appointed regent then.
So you had already sort of had your taste of battle before you ever...
Well, a little bit in this committee, but that was a gentle sort of thing.
Right.
I remember I got in from New York at some very late hour, or early hour in the morning, was in bed asleep, and the telephone rang. It was Earl Warren. And he said, "I've been trying to get you for the last few days. Where have you been?" or something. I said, "Will you accept appointment as a regent of the university?" And I said, "I'd be delighted to." And he said, "That's all I want to hear." He said, "It's practically for a 16-year term, and I know how old you are, and I don't think you'll want another term."
Well, this is a bit unusual for the governor to do his own telephoning, isn't it?
I guess
so. Usually done by somebody prior to the law.
I know him quite well. He was a friend, member of our camp at the Bohemian Grove. I'd seen him quite a lot up there. So,
well,
that's the way it happened. Of course, I was quite pleased.
Yes, I can imagine that that you certainly would be. What is your general recollection of Warren, let's say? I suppose you knew him best when he was governor.
Yes. Yes, I've seen very little of him since he left California. And while I'm not a close family friend of his in any way, most of my friendship has been through the our camp at the Bohemian Grove, where he was a member. That's a very intimate group. And when he was governor, he was up there quite frequently for the 3 weekends. So you do get a chance to sit around, talk. And he's been there several times since he's been Chief Justice, too. Mm-hmm. But, he's a delightful human being, and lovely person.
Yeah.
One you can be very fond of.
Did you have views on his political approaches?
Well, as a conservative, I've been a bit critical of the court, the Warren Court, but I think he's been a consistent liberal, and I think he's been I think he would be regarded as one of the truly great liberal people of the times. Mm-hmm. And my criticism or disagreement with him would be that fundamentally I'm not a liberal. And I think the liberal philosophy, as it's been so well handled by Warren, has been one of the disturbing things of the times. I think he's, in my book, I would much prefer a stricter interpretation of the Constitution. You hear so much about the Bill of Rights today, but this country's lived for a long time under the Bill of Rights without bringing up these questions of today.
Which questions?
Well, let's say free speech. No, as I see it, the application of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution to the life of the country and the law varies with the courts, and there has been built up a long background of just what those procedures in the Bill of Rights means. And I think with the Warren Court, and the general feeling of the times has been to go to a rather great extreme in the liberal direction of interpreting what something like free speech means. Mm-hmm. And today you can do almost anything, call it free speech, and get away with it. If with these obscenities that were shouted now so frequently on the campus would have put a man out of the university 20 years ago without any question, and now it's called free speech, proper expression.
Well, there's a decline in civility. There's no question about that.
And, well, the left wing, we're getting back to this whole question of today, the left wing group, which is now really anti-liberal also, has just putting up the Bill of Rights as a shield, and the courts have given them that shield by, I think, very extreme interpretations.
Are you thinking of the criminal proceedings, the confession issue?
Well, I think all those have moved in the direction of making it awfully hard to get convictions and to carry things through effectively in the courts. One of the great things Warren did in California was appointing a very high-grade judiciary.
Yes, sir.
His appointments were excellent. And I think Warren, as the governor of California, was a very great governor.
Right. Was Roger Treanor one of his?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. But those were great liberals.
Yes.
But they were men of real character.
I see. You're really looking essentially for character, perhaps, rather than for political conviction as such.
Yes. Well, no, I think in the Supreme Court, the only other member of the court I knew was Felix Frankfurter. I knew him very well at Harvard.
Oh.
And Felix Frankfurter was certainly an outstanding Roosevelt liberal. And in my convictions, political feelings, I was very antagonistic to his views, though I regarded him as a good friend. And yet, on the court, he was above all a great lawyer. And he, I'm sure, would put the law and the rigorous interpretations of the law, the meaning of the law, above his own political convictions.
So again, character is
yes.
essential.
Well, and professional training.
I see.
Oh, I perhaps shouldn't say this, but I think Felix Frankfurter was probably 10 times the lawyer that Earl Warren is. Mm-hmm. I think Felix probably had just as deep liberal and convictions as Earl Warren did, but I think in his case, the law and the legal interpretation was the thing that dominated his decisions. Whereas, as I think in Warren's case, if he felt something was right, and he often used that phrase, is it right? He would find a justification in the constitution of the law for what he felt was right. And he had deep feelings about what was right. Whereas I think Frankfurter's feelings would be, is it the law?
Yes, that's an interesting distinction.
And they were both leading liberals in the best meaning, contemporary meaning of that word, I think.
Among the, speaking of Supreme Court people, I think we're all very much interested in them, particularly now. Who were the leading conservatives that you would have admired on the court?
Well, I'd have to go back to Hughes, I think. Yeah, I think he was a great conservative on the court. I didn't know him personally, but I think he was the most outstanding of the conservatives. And, of course, going back farther, I think Mr. Justice Taft was a great conservative and a very distinguished judge on the court. Probably more distinguished as a judge than he was as president.
Yes, that's interesting.
Yes.
He had that.
But I don't think we've had as brilliant conservative leaders since that time.
Different eras seem to call forth different...
Yes, don't they? Don't they?
I see.
Well, perhaps some of the new appointees will turn out to be conservative leaders.
Well, we shall see.
Yeah, we shall see.
Well, I must say, Mr. Blackman has certain promising
He's
qualities.
Sounds all right.
Yeah. Mm. Well, hold a good thought for him.
Yes, he'll probably need it.
Right. Poor man.
Yeah.
Once he's confirmed that, probably the worst of it will be over.
Yes, I hope so.
Well, now that we seem to be really touching on the Regents, shall we pursue that
a
little more? You were on deck there, weren't you, when the first chancellors were appointed? That was after the chancellor's system was developed.
Yes. When I came on first, what did they call them? Provosts, I think.
That's right.
Monroe Deutsch.
That's right.
Was really nominally in charge of the Berkeley campus. But in those days, Bob Spowell really felt he was running the show.
Yes.
And I don't think he could make the transition from the presidency to the type of presidency that we have today very easily. He really was the ideal president of that period when it was the Prexy type of president that everybody knew, everybody loved, and he was a great figure. Of course, that was primarily on the Berkeley campus and to some extent Davis. I don't think he was ever quite able to establish that same position in Los Angeles, though he went down there and lived for half the year at times. But I don't, coming from Northern California and so on, I don't think he was ever able to be the dominant personality on that campus that he was up here, right to the very end of his career. But that type of president is something that's passed. I think we've got a president now who's just ideal for the contemporary presidency, and Charlie Hitch.
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinarily able, analytical mind, but he's not a person to get out and have a voice carry all over the stadium in a rally.
Although people suggest that he's very witty and very engaging.
He's witty, charming, makes a delightful speech, but he's not the orator who could stand up in Sproul Plaza and sway that crowd. I may be mistaken, maybe he is.
But the structure would hardly let him do it.
But that's not his role.
No.
So the qualities that you look for in a president today are totally different from the qualities perhaps that we had in the older days.
Well, this might be interesting to pursue a bit. Now you're looking for certain qualities in a president and certain qualities in a chancellor.
Yes, the chancellors are closer to the role of the old president. And I think that some of the qualities that we used to look for in the presidencies of the old days is still one wants to find in the chancellor. You want somebody who will be looked up to on the campus and would be regarded as a leader, mm-hmm. and that the students respect and like and admire and even have affection for. And I think we do look for that type of person. I think the outstanding chancellor in my day is Emil Marak at Davis. I think he came nearer being the dominant in that good sense personality on the campus that everybody knew, everybody was fond of. There were legends about him, talks, stories about him. And I think he did a great job up there, Davis.
Is the size of the establishment part of the problem?
Well, the size and character of the place is. Now, I'm not as sure if Abel could have done the same thing in Berkeley, but he certainly did it. A beautiful job in Davis, and Davis is a very big place now.
Yes.
But he belonged to Davis, and everybody knew him, admired him, and regarded him as the personality of the campus. To a greater extent, I think, than any of the other chancellors, as a personality.
Yes.
That doesn't mean I have great admiration for our succession of chancellors, for I think we've had some great, very great people in those positions.
Are they nominated through the faculty, or is this entirely a regent's?
No, the chancellors, I suppose legally, they are appointed by the regents, and the regents could initiate and nominate a person without consulting anybody if they wanted to. I think they've got the power. But the procedure is that the regents ask for nominations from the faculty, not generally a man, but a slate from the faculty. And then the regents generally have a committee appointed, a special committee.
A committee of regents?
Of regents, to review names and come up with a nomination. And that committee is instructed to work in closest cooperation with the faculty committee. Now, I had been on several committees of that sort, and I know we met with the faculty committees. The most dramatic one was the selection of Roger Hines in a time we had to have somebody most urgently.
Oh, I believe you. I'm just watching because I want the tape to start again when you...
And I can assure you it was an answer to prayer when Roger accepted.
Now, let's see. You were on the...